The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 42 from the Blue Cliff Record. Layman Pang was leaving Yaoshan's temple. Yaoshan ordered 10 of his monks to see him off at the gate. Layman Pang pointed to the snow falling through the air and said, "Beautiful snowflakes. They don't fall in that other place." One of the monks, whose name was Chan, asked, "Where do they fall?" Pang gave him a slap. Chan said, "Don't be so hasty, Pang." Pang said, "If you speak of yourself as a Chan monk in such poor condition, the king of death will never release you." "What about you, Pang?" asked Chuan. Pang slapped him again and said, "You see with your eyes, but you are just like someone who is blind. You speak with your mouth, but you are just like someone who's dumb." And Zhuido comments, "At the first words, I would have just hit him with a snowball. How glad he would have been." And a lovely little poem that was written by Zen Master Bao Che of Mount Miao. "Beauty of flake, sting of slap. No place but here. No place but here. Beauty of flake, sting of slap, long since gone, long since gone." So this is a koan we are going to look into this weekend, this sesshin. Koans are teaching stories that have been handed down to us from our great ancestors in China, this particular one, 1,200 or so years ago. And this one is a very important koan for many reasons. One in particular is that the main character, the person in this koan, the teacher, is a lay practitioner, Pang. In fact, as far as I know, in the koan curriculum, in the koan collection of all the many hundreds of koans, there are only a couple lay practitioners. One is Pang and one is Vimalakirti, who lived around the time of Buddha. And it's significant to me because I'm a lay practitioner. And all of you are lay practitioners. Typically in the koans, we hear from monks and we hear from teachers who are transmitted, monks who have been living in a monastery, and monks who are primarily men. But it's sort of ironic to me that lay practitioners and women haven't been so much included in much of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, up until lately. I find it ironic because, according to Stephen Batchelor, the Buddhist scholar, in his book, After Buddhism, he shows and talks about how the Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha, invited lay practitioners and women He invited his family, his wife and children. In fact, his two close allies, two close adherents, one was a merchant and the other was a politician. But it seems throughout history, when Buddhism turned from a primarily language and verbal communication, verbally passed down, it was written down by monks who were men. So it seems that maybe they biased men and monks. And certainly, this tradition of monasteries, living in a monastery, is a powerful, powerful way of practicing. And yet, Layman Pang stands out in this wonderful tradition of stories, of Zen stories, koans. Maybe because he had a particular person who was writing for him, who was advocating for a lay practitioner. I'm not sure. I don't know. But even though he stands rather solitary among monks, mendicants, monastery practitioners, he was a great enlightened being. He didn't have his own lineage. He didn't pass on. But he had a wonderful presence in his life that he was able to bring the Buddha teachings to his family, to his community, and to everyone that he taught. His wife was an adherent, was a practitioner. His daughter was a practitioner. And according to some, his daughter was even surpassed his great understanding. We don't hear much of that, though, unfortunately. Probably because they weren't transmitted. They didn't have a lineage. Layman Pang was a student of the great Master Matsu, or we know great Master Ma, that we read about in our koan curriculum. He was also a student of Shito, who you may recognize from his writing, The Grassroots Hermitage. He was well renowned. There's a story about him, how he took up the way with his family, and he actually came from some money, and he was a merchant himself. But at one point in his life and his family's life, he decided that this practice was too important to hang on to material things too tightly. And the legend goes that he put all his material belongings on a boat, rowed it out to the middle of a lake and sunk them all. And when he was asked, well, why didn't you just donate that to the poor? He said, these material things are fetters. I wouldn't want them to drag anyone else down. Quite a commitment from a lay practitioner. But he went around and he did visit other monasteries speaking. And here he was at Yaoshan's monastery. Perhaps for a practice period, practice maybe giving some talks. It was probably in that time quite a distinction because he was known as a lay person among monks. And so when we consider monks and monastery, people living in a monastery, there's a real focus of practice. Constantly, day in and day out, meditation, doing what we're doing here for the next 3 days. Although many of them did it for 3 months or 3 years or more, lived their lives in it. So I've heard often from people that, you know, that's the real practice. If you become a monk, then you're really a practitioner. I don't see it that way, actually. Sure, this practice is incredibly focused when you stay in a monastery. And yet, as Dogen said, realization is here right now. And so this koan reveals that. Layman Pang was leaving Yaoshan's temple, and Yaoshan ordered 10 of his monks to see him off at the gate. Why was that? 10 monks? Was he that honored? Perhaps. Or maybe Yaoshan thought that he could teach these 10 monks something. He would have something for them. And he did, indeed he did. Pointing at snow. Beautiful snow. A finger of awakening, a finger of realization pointing at this snow. A wonderful and somewhat mundane statement, beautiful snow. But like any great Zen teacher, it's a setup. Beautiful snow. And then he said, it doesn't fall in that other place. In some translations, it says, it doesn't fall anywhere else. What? What's that? I can just imagine the gears spinning in those monks' heads. I could probably imagine it here. Beautiful snow. But it doesn't fall in that other place. What could that mean? And this beautiful snow, perhaps even more than this word beautiful, is that this word could mean not a judgment of snow, but something deep and intrinsic to the reality of snow, this reality that arises here and now. It doesn't fall in that other place. So one brave monk, we all admire, there's always one of them in these stories, named Chuang, stepped forward and said, where do they fall? And Pang gave him a slap. He gave him a slap. Now I want to talk a little bit about that slap, because we don't do that here in our organization, our temple. We probably wouldn't be able to get insurance to be able to do that. And it's not our tradition, thankfully. But you see a lot of this slapping and hitting in Zen koans and Zen stories. And I do believe that that is part of the machoistic tradition of men, mendicants and monks and teachers. But there are other ways of teaching. Poetry, for one. Some silence for others. Some screaming, yelling, just shouting, hey! But that's important to note that Pang didn't hit him because he was being condescending or putting him in his place or punishing him or any sort of retribution. No. Pang was saying, look, here, right here, right here. Beautiful snow. They don't fall in that other place. A few weeks ago, back in January, I was trail running, which is I love to do, and out in the woods in a town near here in Holden. And there were probably about 4 inches of snow and ice on the trails. So I had my spikes that I put on my running shoes. Crunch, 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 crunch through that snow. Feeling my breath coming out into the air. And it was one of those days that I think most of us who live in the snow country or anywhere there's lots of snow, it was dark, clouded, midday, but dark and cloudy, fully overcast. And the air was still, somewhat biting moisture. And this kind of day is the day you just know it's going to snow. It's going to snow any moment. You can feel it in the air. And there I was, crunch, 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 pushing through the snow. And all of a sudden, there was snow. At first, little specks of white popping up over. And then more snow. Snow falling. I say falling, but it was just there. Snow above me, snow around me, behind me, below me, filling the air. It was just there. Now, something happens sometimes when you're in snow, a little, a disorienting feeling, because you may know that you focus your eye on a snowflake and you lose sight of it. And then you try to follow it, and then you get enveloped by the other pieces of snow. And then all of a sudden, you're just in snow. There's no falling. It's just there, this incredible activity that surrounded me. It was like nature was cradling me, holding me. That reality was expressing itself in its most beautiful way. And it wasn't falling anywhere else. It was falling just for me. When we sit here in Sesshin, especially in the late afternoon, and we're tired, hungry, we hear that chop, 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 chop of the knife hitting the cutting board in the kitchen. There it is. Right there, right here. Doesn't chop in that other place. And when those thoughts start clouding our minds, why am I so tired? Why do my legs ache? When is the bell going to ring? Was this a good idea? I don't know. They whirl and swirl like snowflakes. They don't occur. They don't fall in that other place. Right here. All of your practice, everything you've done from the beginning of your life to here, every moment you've meditated, every sutra you've read, every single moment you spent in Dokusan, walking meditation, all the practices of this wonderful Zen tradition, all resolve to this, all of it, right here. Tasting the richness of that is incredible. even for one solitary moment. We aren't here to study the philosophy of Zen. We aren't even here to be good Zen students. We aren't here to understand these difficult koans. We're here to awaken to this great intimacy, which is always here, waiting for you. Snow, thoughts, chop, chop, chop. This is it. This is it. The great master Baoche of Mount Miao, Mount Mayu, said, "Beauty of flake, sting of slap. No place but here. No place but here. Beauty of flake, sting of slap. Long since gone. Long since gone." Thank you. So I invite you all to sit comfortably. We're going to enter into our Dharma dialogue portion. And folks, at the end of the Zendo, if you could just kind of curl in a little bit, make a big mute, like we did last night. Folks on the screen, if you have a question, raise your Zoom hand. And in the temple, if you have a question, raise your physical hand. And Melissa and I and David Roshi are will settle the matter for you. Paul.
Thanks for the talk, Michael. I feel like I've cheated a little bit because Michael had reached out to me and told me that this was going to be the koan to be discussed, and had a chance to look at it a little bit, and so many things were coming up for me, but it was really your first words that struck me. When you said that you identify with this, at least layman Peng, because you're a layman. And you said, "We're all laymen." It's so interesting because within me, I'm like, "But I'm ordained," you know, and you're transmitted, you know, and I love how quickly that mind wants to separate. Mm-hmm. And then could just, as you were talking, it's like, well, of course I'm a householder. Of course we're all lame. Why am I, you know, is even the wise is extra, but just to really notice how quickly I can try to make that mm-hmm. division. And in this case, as you're pointing out, history has excluded, you know, through that division. I'm here. I'm a practitioner, and we're all here practicing together. What more needs to be said?
Thanks for saying that, Paul. I actually had a very similar response. But what about me? What about Ray? What about Paul? You know, we're all here. But that tendency of the mind to make categories, right? That's so lay and ordained, transmitted, and, you know, hoi polloi, I don't know what you want to call it, as if. And of course, men and women. Oh my goodness. You know, that's huge for me. And there are all these other divisions, but it's the divisions themselves are koans, mm-hmm. right? As I was getting dressed twice, because you have to take all this stuff off to go to the bathroom, by the way. It's like, you know, how you have to take off your raksu to go to the bathroom. Well, there's three layers of raksu-like things here. And as I was taking it off and putting it on, and I was thinking, why are we doing this? This is ridiculous. And then I suddenly had this very strong thought. Being ordained is its own thing. It's beautiful. It has all kinds of treasures associated with, just like being a woman is a beautiful thing. Being gay is a beautiful thing. Being whatever, you know, any of those categories. So it's really a koan, right? There, and it is form and differentiation. And so one, that is one, oneness and differentiation. So there, we are all sincere practitioners of the way, and we're young and old, and we're he's and they's, and you know, all these different ways that we differentiate ourselves are also important. If we just get caught in oneness, we're, you know, that's it. We're never going to survive. I mean, you can survive for a short period of time living in oneness, but ultimately, you know, you have to be able to tell the difference between the rat poison and the oatmeal, right? It's just the way it is. So this is just, I love that you're pointing to it. And I love that I got to respond to you. This is how we enter the way, form, emptiness, thusness, specificity, whatever we want to call it, right? Priest, lay person. Yeah. Thanks.
Also say that, you know, this is the wonderful job of Zen teachers. I mean, it's as soon as you start leaning in one direction, they boop, push you off in the other direction. And then you start leaning in that direction. They go, whoop, and they push you back. And that constant back and forth across that middle line, that's where a good Zen teacher shines. And we have some good ones here.
Well, and just one more thing about that. Whenever one of us gives a Dharma talk, we can only say one side of it. So we have to, I love the Dharma dialects because that's where we get to say the other side of it. So the whole Sangha comes forth like that. Yeah.
So Corwin first.
Thank you for the talk, Michael. And similarly to Paul and Melissa, I had the same thought. I'm like, wait, what about me? But as Melissa was talking about having to take everything off to go to the bathroom, well, the first thing that popped in my head was Paul's words of wisdom way back when I was first getting ordained, said stop drinking anything about an hour before you need to put your makeup on. Then it solves the problem. But you know, I was thinking one thing that popped up in my head was there's another koan that says, you know, why do we put on the 7-piece robe? And I was thinking, you know, there are a few of us who are wearing these okesa, but then there are several more who are wearing the rakusu, which is the mini version of it. And yet every single one of us together chanted the verse of the kesa this morning because it doesn't matter at one level. And so it just, that all kind of just fit together with your talk. And it was just kind of a neat brief moment of something that went off in my head. Maybe it was an aneurysm, I don't know. Thank you.
We can't see you.
Let me just say, just appreciating the both sides, of course, and noticing how for each one of us, we can use whatever rank or statuses we occupy to separate ourselves. And we can separate ourselves by, well, I'm a this, and people like me are, or how come I'm not a that? I so wish I was that. So this beautiful interplay of, you know, thankfully, Jamie as Tenzo knows that he is cooking the food, right? If he thinks all things are one and the food will cook itself, people in the temple will grow quite hungry. If Bill doesn't remember to ring the bell, that he is the timekeeper. So we play these roles, and each role contains all of them, and every person here shines forth with the particular light, the particular expression of this inexpressible Dharma.
Thank you. Bill.
Give you a chance to get some exercise.
Thank you, Michael.
What came up for me was another koan, actually, about the two monks walking along the river, and there were two crows pulling a frog apart. And the one monk said, "See that? That is being done just for you." And so it can be beautiful snow that's falling right here in place that's so beautiful and wonderful, but also the unpleasant things that are occurring are being done just for you.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, just for you. It kind of blows the mind when you think, oh, wait a minute, no, well, it's for everybody else too, and that thinking that gets, but no, it's here. You, and not in any other place.
And in that particular koan, the line is usually translated, it's for your benefit, right? Not only just this is for you, but this is something that's being given to you to help you with your insight. How could that be when the terrible things happen? You know, the frog being pulled apart. And this is another form of the oneness and differentiation, right? That in oneness, everything is for your benefit, but also in differentiation, it's like, oh no, that poor frog, the people who are suffering here, there, and everywhere in the world. It's both. Yeah, it's both. Beautiful collection. Yeah.
Madhu.
Yeah, thank you for your talk, Michael. So, you know, where I went with it was sort of, you know, I hear this teaching about here and now and no gap and oneness. And I get it that that's what it was talking about. But to me, you know, it's again, there's a place where that's not enough, you know, otherwise, why did Layman Peng have to ask the question, and why did he even have to slap the monk if, you know, it was just about this and that's it. And, you know, if it was just about that, then why do we even have to talk about it? Why did he have to, you know? So, I mean, I just wanted to point that
out.
Yeah,
yeah. Madhu reminds me of another story of a student who came into a teacher and said, "Is this it?" And the teacher said, "No." right. So is this it? We make up categories. We say, "Oh yeah, yeah, oneness and da da. Yeah, I know about all that." But there are so many different kinds of knowing, and just like knowing spaghetti is not the same as eating spaghetti. Not nearly as nourishing. This teaching of intimacy and this teaching of right here, although it's so obvious, it so quickly turns into a concept. And then we hold on to the concept, and it is not enough. And so just really appreciating this not enough, that if you think you have it, if you think you have enough, you cannot truly practice. You're lost in oneness, you're lost in delusion. So this not enough, always moving us into this inexpressible, wondrous Dharma beyond anything we can say or think.
And you might also say, this is a little bit of a reassurance, there's many levels of the teaching, right? So there are some levels, some ways of teaching that our ancestors called them peeling a lychee nut. You know, they go down smooth. They're easy. Everything is right here is a great example of it. Beautiful snowflakes, you know, something beautiful, something clear like that. And then I think Layman Peng was doing something similar in this dialogue. And then it wasn't enough. So he had to slap the monk. The slapping is a different kind of teaching. It's not a peeled lychee nut. It hurts, right? And the poem that Michael read from our ancestor, Mount teacher Bao Jie from Mount Mayu, he's doing something very similar in that story. That's a great story where, you know, somebody comes along. We sometimes talk about that there are a couple of levels. So there's the obvious level, and then there's the upside down level. In some of the koans, they talk about this is the first level, the second level. But then if you start talking that way, you're wrong. It's the same thing. It's the sameness and differentiation thing again, right? So you don't want to stay in any one of these places. But when you're dissatisfied, when you think, I got it, yep, okay, check. Another thing I know about Zen, that's when I feel like a new door opens. You really get to say, wait a minute, it couldn't be like this. I hear the news. What's going on? It couldn't be that simple. Right? So I think we're just saying the same thing in different ways. Trust yourself. Understand the teachings where at whatever level you get to them, and then ask more. But what about this? But what about this? Is why we have Michael kept referring to the koan curriculum. Those of you who do practice koans, we start with a koan and it opens to some of these primary teachings. It opens you, and then it's not enough. You think, oh, okay, I get that part, and then you do another level, and it takes you to another level. And I gotta say, even when you reach the end of our Boundless Way Zen curriculum, there's more. It never ends. It doesn't matter whether you're ordained or transmitted or whether you've been teaching for 20 years. Or this is a path that never ends. So you just keep going, going. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Okay. You get it.
Let's see. No, Bix or Will.
I think Bix.
Bix, yeah, you threw it up first. Okay, I just didn't.
It was hard to see.
As well.
Oh, no.
Yeah, thank you for the talk, Michael. I especially appreciate this because this is something I've struggled with. And I want to preface this first by saying I don't really understand my own confusion about this. But yeah, you know, I spent some time at a monastery and I was really happy there. And of course this was conditional happiness. And then I came back and I was like, I need to go back. Like I can't be here. And, you know, I've cut through that delusion a little bit. And I'm of course incredibly grateful to be in Worcester at college and with my partner and at the temple and with my friends and whatnot. But you know, so there's the oneness that there are no distinctions. And so at a certain point, you know, the main thing that comes to mind is why did Layman Peng have to go to a monastery? And isn't that distinction important?
Simply say that's because we're the people are, we're the people practicing. The distinction between monastic, there is a distinction, as Melissa was saying, and there is a distinction between lay practitioners. But that doesn't mean we just don't, we cut off one side and don't view the other. I mean, he was obviously an incredible teacher, you know, and he was asked probably to teach there.
And just actually what we know about him, there's actually, even though there aren't that many koans about him in our curriculum, there's a whole collection of stories about him called The Teachings of Layman Peng that are really worth reading. He went, he had his own awakening experience and studied with a few teachers to do just the very thing that Modu was talking about. He wasn't satisfied. So he went everywhere. There are stories about him at all the different monasteries of the time. So Matsu I don't know if he gave him transmission, but he studied with Matsu for a long time. And these other teachers, he was just visiting Yao Shan. We don't know if he was giving a talk. Probably he was receiving teachings. And he was relentless, right? He didn't have a settled abode, which is another thing about him. What, not just that he was a lay person, but also that he didn't stick around anywhere and grow roots. And the story, if you read these stories, they're very inspiring. That relentless practice, I think, is what I really love to see in a student, right? That And I have it myself, just never giving up, never giving up. So he had to challenge himself. He knew that he could, if he didn't, he would just, you know, he'd have that one awakening experience, grab onto it, make it into a story, and that would be dead practice. And he actually says that to the guy, you know, the who he slaps, you know, the what is it, the god of death, the demon of death, yeah, will never release you. He's talking about that there was in this monastic system a real criticism of people. They're called rice bags, who just went to monasteries to eat the rice and just be happy, right? But it, you know, as you said, it's conditional happiness. It disappears if you live in a monastery for a really long time. It's just like going to college or, you know, getting married and buying a house. It's all this stuff. It doesn't matter. There's going to be a dissatisfaction that arises. That was the original teaching of the Buddha. So that's my sense of why he kept going from place to place to place. And remember, Michael referred to it. His daughter was considered a much wiser person than Layman Pang. And there's some wonderful teachings in the record of Layman Pang about her and also his wife. You don't hear about the son that much, but he was definitely part of this crazy family. And they were raised in a city where they were educated. And then when they gave everything up, they all went with him. That, you know, dad wants to do this. Okay, you know, pile in the station wagon, let's do it. It's very instructive because it keeps shifting directions, his life. And also this koan, you know, so we don't want the demon of death to hold on to us. We want to be free. This is about freedom, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, also going back to what someone said last night about coming here on retreat so they could enter the world more fully. So all of us in some way are monks. We've all taken vows these 3 days at the temple or at your home or apartment. And we do this in order to look into the great matter in this way. And then we leave with the same intention to look into the great matter day after day in all the variety of forms it arises.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael, for the talk. So while you were going along, I was traveling along with you and thinking, oh, well, the place where the snow doesn't fall is also the place where the snow falls. It's a deeper level. And I thought, oh, I've got this one. And of course I didn't. And it seemed too zen-y for me. But then you said something about everything that we've done in our lives, all the practice, all the sesshins, all the dokusan, it leads up to this very moment. And I've been finding that in my practice lately, that when I'm thinking of the past, I immediately start a narrative that leads to the present. And then when I think of the future, I can think of a narrative that goes from the future and leads to the present. And I'm never really here in the present. So insurance companies aside, I think it would be great to get a slap every now and then.
Yeah, Bob, come a little closer.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. You know, that you're right. And though the whole past that's in the past is right here. It's right here. And then the future that's in the future is right here. And we could see that too, that in the snow right here. What flake we're following doesn't matter. It's just, it's snow. It's us and it's this moment here.
And I have to say, we do slap people. We do. Many of you have received slaps, right? Not literal,
yeah,
bang on the face kind of slaps, but kind of like, hey, pay attention, ring the bell differently, walk faster, walk slower. You know, all the forms of Zen allow a space for slaps. And that it's a kind of sweet thing. It's not, I had a student who one of his first sessions, he was kind of lost in thought during Kinhin. ever happen to you? You don't even know where you are. And that, if it hasn't happened yet, in a couple of days, it probably will. But he was just kind of looking around and, you know, not following the person in front of him. And I came over to him and tapped him on the shoulder and said, pay attention, pointing to the shoulders of the person in front of him, because that's what you watch, by the way, in Kinhin. You don't watch their feet. Then you're just stumbling over yourself. You just watch that rhythm. And I didn't think much of it. 10 years later, he came back to me and he said, that moment changed my life. No, I didn't mean to do it. I just wanted to keep the Kinhin line. But it changed his life because it was a slap. It was perceived that way, and he bowed to it, right? He said, okay. And so this is part of what we're doing when we're teaching. When the Tanto pulls you aside, it's a loving slap, right? It's not a you idiot kind of slap. It's holding the whole community in her loving arms. This is, and if you can be grateful for it, which is hard because we're also sensitive to criticism, it's not really criticism. It's just I don't even know what to call it, but yeah. So we do slap.
Well,
he's got the fix.
I'm thinking of selling slap insurance soon. I have a question, but I just wanted to say that this last point has been very helpful for me. I had a phone conversation with an old friend who's, you know, been a little bit curious about what it is that I do when I go on these Zen retreats. And I happened to say this time that I was, I'd been asked to be Eno and chant leader and, you know, hadn't done that before. I was a little apprehensive. And she, you know, with the best intentions said, now, wait a minute, Will, is that you taking on too much again? Are you just trying to please people and da da da? And I thought, you know, she's sort of looking at, because she would say the same thing about my work life, right? I say yes too much and so on. And I said, no, you know, it's not like that at all. And I guess this conversation is really helping me see that. It's like another chance to mess up over and over and over again. And there really is something helpful about that in a strange way. It's a little hard to explain, but I think it's just what you're saying, that you sort of, I mean, I see my own reactions like, oh God, I effed up again and da da da. And then you get a chance to sort of look at that watch it, you know, get worse and get better and so on. So that really spoke to me. If I can quickly change topic, this just ever since you read the poem, Michael, I felt as though it was beautiful, and I felt as though in some way I understood the end of it, but I couldn't possibly articulate it. Long since passed, something of that sort. It caught me by surprise, and I thought, oh God, that's, what is that? I love it. I don't get it.
Yeah, long since gone, long since gone.
Yeah, right.
Right. Slap.
Gone. Right here, long since gone.
Gone already. Yeah,
I love it.
And you know what I love about this slap is it's all a slap. If we pay attention, it's all here for our express purpose of waking up every single moment, which, and it just, a physical slap is a little more breaks through a little more, but every moment is a slap.
Why is it gone then? And when did it go?
Indeed.
Yes, that's the question.
Just time is a version of narration, of story making, right? That, like Bob was saying, this everything that's happened leads to this, and now the things that are going to happen. That's another story for the moments when we remember in a long life. They're happening right now, but they're gone. So I'm not explaining it. I'm suggesting you use it as a koan.
Yeah, and I would say gate, gate, paragate, parasam, gate, bodhisvaha, gone, gone, ungraspable, wondrous, incomprehensible. Yay.
Esther.
So thank you so much for the talk, Michael. I felt like I was running quietly behind you in the forest, afraid to fall and hearing the crutch, crutch, crutch. And, you know, where I'm kind of going with the impressions and the imprint of your talk is to this place of the sting of slap and the snowflake, and that sometimes so helpful to be stopped in our tracks, in my tracks of, could this be it? There has to be more. Like, how could this be it? Mm. Right. And so when we are in extreme weather conditions, suddenly there's a lot of rain on the road, and I have to drive slowly. And we are stopped in our tracks and just looking at life right now as it is. And could it be enough? Can I rest my mind in a radical trust that this is enough?
Thank you. You know, you just described why I come from to Sashin. Because I want to put myself in the track of a slap. I want the opportunity, and there's no better opportunity to get slapped and to be waking up and stopped in my tracks. That's what Sashin does for me. It stops me in my tracks.
Yeah, thank you.
Zeph. That's me.
So one thing I've been watching everyone all the time and myself as well. I find when I get feedback or slaps and other people too, all of us, this is my observation. One of the first things that comes up is this, what I was thinking was this, or here's a, you know, this like, you're being too hasty. You didn't really understand me. And in Sashin, that's really opened up in my life in general. There is such a strong desire to be correctly understood. Mm. Even like when you're talking with somebody, hey, could you pick them up at this? And actually they're going to do the right thing, but they didn't fully understand what you mean. There's this like, no, I kind of meant that. It's so interesting to me. Like, why is it so important to be, for the other person to see what I'm thinking the right, like it's critical, you know? So it's kind of a question of, for me, it's kind of a practice of like, what would it be like to be okay with being misunderstood? You know, for example, you know, coming in and then Melissa is like, you didn't bow at the door. And I go, yes, I did. And, did I? And then I go, you know what? I'll take that as remember to bow at the door. You know, if I did, I did. If I didn't, I didn't, but I'll remember to bow at the door next time. We'll see what happens. You know, it's relieving in a way, you know, you're not going to be understood. That's fine. Yeah.
You know, I love that because we remember that it's not about bowing at the door. It's about waking up. So whatever you think you're wrong about or you were misunderstood about, that's just sort of like the container for this wonderful gone. Practice. Long gone. Sure. That too.
Yeah, and you know, this is such an opportunity, right, to see the arising of, I'm going to use the E word, ego. Mm. Because it's normal to protect the self in all situations, and the animal body reacts. There's a reaction always. And then the mind rushes in and makes a story about it. So this wanting to be seen is it's so deep and elemental for all of us. I agree with you. And to be free of that, just as you say, to be free of that opens up a whole new life. Who cares whether, you know, I thought I bowed. I thought I did the right thing. I, right? And then you see, maybe it doesn't matter, right? Maybe it's all meaningless. And my first teacher always used to say that, stop trying to make meaning out of everything. But it's a habit. We grew up this way, making meaning. And I'm thinking too about, so the sequence is you receive the slap. We're calling it a slap, but yeah, because it feels that way. It stings a little bit. We receive the slap, and then to pause and feel into how that is for us is so important, to feel the body's protective structure coming in. It's so beautiful. You know, it's like hearing the tiger in the jungle, and you just start running. You don't even think about it, but then you think, oh, I'm running because I'm getting away from the tiger. Everything gets muddied. So this instantaneous reaction, and then the pausing, and then the going with, and then the opening. I think that it doesn't always happen in that order, but that's the opportunity. You know, it's for your benefit. That's the, right. Even if it's meaningless, like that guy that I corrected years ago, I didn't mean to give him a Zen teaching, you know, and yet now I know that pretty much everything is. So thank you for the way you receive. Receiving is a big part of it.
That time.
Don't even make a story.
So thank you all for participating. Could you come back to our postures and move your cushions back to the rows?